Open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 5, and we're going to be looking at Solomon's temple this morning and have an outline on the back of the handout there, just the things that this is a difficult passage for a teacher to try to deal with and teach, and to come away with applications for, and come away with applications from this passage. And so as I looked at it, I thought, well, what are the things that we really need as we walk away from this passage? What do we need to be knowing and understanding? And so our outline for the talk, for the lesson this morning is going to be what we need to know about Israel's places of worship, what we need to know specifically about Solomon's temple. We're going to have a little discussion, which was better, the temple or the tabernacle? And then to really zero in on Solomon's prayer of dedication, and finally, God's response to Solomon's prayer. So that will be the outline for our lesson this morning. Let's start off what we need to know about Israel's places of worship. And I'm only speaking of those sanctioned places of worship, not the places where they were worshiping, where they weren't supposed to be worshiping. But what was the very first place of worship for the Israelites? The first sanctioned place of worship. It doesn't get any easier. The tabernacle. We had the tabernacle. Tabernacle was first built around 1445 B.C. as part of the Exodus, and they utilized it to some degree or another up until at least 1050 B.C., and that's when it was captured. They took the Ark of the Covenant into battle with them against the Philistines. The Ark of the Covenant was captured, and you know the story, and it was never really taken back, even after it was returned by the Philistines. It was never returned to the tabernacle. The Ark stayed in one place, and the tabernacle stayed in another. And for about the next 100 years until 950 B.C. Now, in 950 B.C. is when about the time Solomon's temple came into being, the starting of the construction. It took them 7 years to build it. So from 950 B.C. until 587 B.C., we have Solomon's temple. And at 587 B.C. is when Jerusalem was captured by the Babylonians for the third time. And all of the fine buildings in the city were destroyed. The walls were torn down. All of the beautiful buildings were thoroughly destroyed, including the temple. So the temple was destroyed in 587 B.C. After Solomon's temple, we have Zerubbabel's temple. Zerubbabel was part of the exiles who returned from Babylon. And about 515 B.C., so we have a gap of time in there when there was not a temple, but he began building the temple around 515 B.C., and I don't have an ending date there for his temple, because his temple never was really destroyed. It just sort of blended over into the next temple, which would have been Herod's temple. Now, Zerubbabel's temple, that was the one that was in place when Antiochus Epiphanes went in and desecrated the temple in 168 B.C. But around 20 B.C., Herod began converting the temple. And, of course, we'll see how Solomon's temple was just a place of great grandeur and beauty. Zerubbabel's temple was rather plain and just not nearly as ornate as Solomon's. Herod took measures to really beautify the temple and make it into a grand project. And as Tom Pennington has been sharing on some Sunday evenings lately, he's gone into some of the details there. But that began about 20 B.C., and it took him all the way up until 64 B.C. to complete that building project. And you can remember from the Gospel accounts how the disciples were walking in the temple area with Jesus, and they were commenting about how beautiful all these buildings were. And Jesus says, "Do you see all these buildings here? There shall not be one stone left on top of another." And sure enough, that came to pass, because they finally finished all the construction in 64 A.D. only to have it thoroughly destroyed 6 years later in 70 AD. So, are those all of the temples that are associated with the Jewish people? I mean, got any more temples coming? Yes, we have at least one more temple coming, and that is during the millennium. Ezekiel's temple will be built during the millennial period. Well, that's what we need to know about Israel's places of worship in a nutshell. What do we need to know about Solomon's temple? We have just a lot of facts, a lot of factual information presented for us here in these chapters. And as I come away from it, I say, well, what are the essentials that we really need to know about Solomon's temple? Well, the first thing we need to keep in mind is that God chose the location for this temple. Could I have someone look up 1 Chronicles 21:18? And if someone else will look up 1 Chronicles 22:1. If someone would look up 21:18 and then just read it for us. And if somebody else will look up 1 Chronicles 22:1. Okay. Who has 21:18? Okay, and this was the particular incident was when a plague had David had sinned by taking the census, and a plague had come upon Israel, and God told David to specifically go to this point, this place, and construct an altar. Rod, would you read 22:1 for us, please? Right, and again, we have to put that in context. It's hard to glean a lot from just that one verse, but the context is David is speaking of this point, this place where God had told him to build the altar, and now he's saying, well, this is where God is. You know, we're going to build the house of God here on this place. God had said back in Deuteronomy that he would identify the place where he was to be worshipped. He would call it out, and this is how he did so. He told David to build the altar on that spot, and then David said, this is the spot where we are going to build God's house, a temple to worship him. So God chose the location for this temple. And we need to know that the temple was very similar to the tabernacle in its arrangement, but it was more complex and more ornate. And here's just one person's diagram of, as they've read through the text, to see how the temple was likely arranged. It had the inner... Do I have a cursor here? I don't, because I have a cursor this morning. But you can see where it has the inner chamber that's the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant is, and that's to the very left of the picture. And it has two cherubim there, or wooden cherubim, over the Ark of the Covenant, the larger room being the holy place. And the building itself was not a huge building. Now, you have some rooms around the side that don't quite go as tall as the rest of the temple, and that would be storerooms, and it would be where the priest would stay. But the temple building itself was not a large building. I doubt that its footprint was as large as the fellowship hall here. It was taller, but not nearly so large. But it's very similar in arrangement to the tabernacle in that it had the holy place and the Holy of Holies, and then the outer courtyard on the outside. So we see that God chose the location for the temple, that it was similar to the tabernacle, but more complex and more ornate. It was about twice the size of the tabernacle. And let me see if I can find these dimensions here. It was about 90 feet long by 30 feet wide by 45 feet high. So a 90-foot by 30-foot building, that's not real big. Again, I don't think that the footprint is as large as the fellowship hall here that we're sitting in, all three rooms, and it's certainly smaller than the children's building that we're planning on building. So that might be kind of surprising to think. We've always heard so much about this wonderful temple of Solomon, and it was a wonderful, beautiful temple, but the building itself, the footprint was not that large. Although it was fairly tall, 45 feet tall, that would be that'd be about three stories high, at least three stories high, 3 to 4 stories high. So a small building, but tall. And even so, it was about twice the dimensions of the tabernacle. And that's going to be a trend that we see as we compare the tabernacle to the temple. We see bigger, we see more ornate, we see more furnishings and things like that. But not a huge, huge building. We need to know that the temple was built at a time when Israel was at peace. And this is a key point that as we read through the scriptural accounts, it keeps on coming back to this. David could not construct it because David was a man of war, but Solomon was a prince of peace. And because of this time of peace in the nation, not only in the nation, but around the nation, because of this period of peace, they were able to construct this temple. Very significant that it was built during a time of peace, a time when Israel was at peace. We see from the biblical account that David made provisions for the temple, but the people donated more provisions. Very specific, particularly in the closing chapters of 1 Chronicles. David put back a lot of gold, a lot of silver, a lot of bronze, and they start listing the amounts of gold and listing the amounts of silver, and then finally they get to the bronze, and they said, we can't even count the bronze. And so they don't even bother counting the bronze. And he gives the people opportunity to donate more. So it's significant that David made provisions. He put back a lot of provisions for the temple. And when we start seeing, you start reading through just how it was built, you get an appreciation for the vast quantities of gold that were needed for the temple. After they built this temple, this 30 foot by 90 foot by 45 foot tall structure, they put cedar on all of the inside. They overlaid the inside with cedar, and then they overlaid all of the cedar with gold. So it was a tremendous amount of gold, and then they used gold for other things that went into the temple. Tremendous amount of gold and other precious metals went into the temple. And we see that the cedars came from Lebanon. And I just included this picture here because I liked this picture. This guy is called Gustave Doré. If you're old enough, you can remember a lot of the Bibles at one period of time had these great engravings by Gustave Doré. And so I just like the pictures that he did. So I stuck this picture of the cedars, these guys cutting these cedars up in Lebanon that were destined for the temple. So the cedars came from Lebanon, and the quarries, the stones came from local quarries. And it's interesting for us to note that at the quarries, they would dress the stones at the quarries themselves and cut them so precisely such that when they delivered them to the temple, they all fit together, and there wasn't any sound of a hammer going on or any iron tool being used in the temple while the temple was being constructed as a sign of reverence. We can recall instructions from the Pentateuch that when altars were to be constructed, they were not to be constructed using iron tools, and kind of taking that and being reverent, that even while they were building this temple, they were not going to be using iron tools to do the work. We need to know that Solomon conscripted tremendous amounts of labor for this temple construction. We read that he drafted 30,000 men, and these were Israelites, to go to Lebanon and help the Sidonians to cut and transport the trees. He made this treaty with Hiram, king of Tyre. He says, look, nobody can cut cedar and do cedar the way that your people can do. So you know, if you will provide me with the timber, and they went into a business arrangement. It wasn't just Hiram doing this out of the goodness of his heart. They entered into a business deal, into a treaty. But Solomon would supply Israelite workers to go up and help with the task. He drafted 30,000 men, and he would send them off in groups of 10,000 each month. A man would go work in Lebanon and help the Sidonians cut and transport the timber for a month, and then he'd come home. He'd be home for 2 months. So it took 30,000 men working in three shifts to do that. But in addition to the men who were going off and helping the Sidonians cut the cedars, they also took Canaanite slaves, the people who were in the lands of the descendants of the Amorites, Perizzites, Jebusites, all the otherites, who were still in the land. Solomon made slaves of these people, and he put them to work in the quarries. Had 70,000 men cutting stones in the hills, and he had another 80,000 cutting or carrying the stones. And then on top of that, he had 3,300 who were foremen. And then on top of those, he had another 550 Jewish men who were foremen. So you add all these numbers together. Where am I going with all these numbers? He had a workforce of almost 200,000 men. So think about this. 200,000 men working for at least 7 years to build this temple. Now, he had other building projects going on as well. This is going to factor in significantly into some of our later stories. So, but this is something important that we need to keep in mind right now, is that Solomon had conscripted a huge labor force for the construction of this temple. We need to know that it started 480 years after they left Egypt. And as I've mentioned several times, it took them 7 years to build the temple. 480 years after leaving Egypt, we know that Saul reigned for 40 years. David reigned for 40 years. So that takes care of 80 years under a monarchy. From this, we can gather that the period of the judges lasted for about 400 years. So this is a good verse for us, one of those little hooks in the Bible that lets us come along and pinpoint just where things are going chronologically and how long some of these different periods lasted. So it took them 480 years after they left Egypt. They started building the temple, and it took them 7 years to build it. Let's take a look at the temple furnishings. We see that we'll come back and talk about these a little more. It had something called the bronze sea. It had bronze basins. It had lampstands. It had tables for showbread. It had a bronze altar. And coming back to this diagram here, you can see the bronze sea. This is in the lower right-hand portion. It's called the laver or the molten sea. This was a huge thing. It was 15 feet in diameter, 7.5 feet high, much larger than the similar piece of furniture that they had at the tabernacle. You'll recall the tabernacle had something very similar to this, but it was smaller. So again, we see the temple takes what the tabernacle had, makes it bigger, makes it grander. This was used by the priest for washing. Obviously, they'd have to have some sort of stand to get up there. It was just too big. You couldn't just walk up to something 7.5 feet high and use it to wash yourself. They had to have some means of getting up there to it. The movable bronze basins, these were, I don't particularly see these on this particular diagram, but they were about 6 foot by 6 foot square and about 4.5 feet tall. You can imagine something about the size, a little bit smaller than the bed of a pickup truck. They were made out of bronze. They were on wheels. The priest would use these to wash the various pieces of the offering. You may recall that as the offering was cut up, there were pieces that they had to take, and the priest would take them and wash them before that they would sacrifice them. Well, this would be what the bronze basins were for. and there were 10 of them. Lampstands. There were 10 lampstands. Remember, the tabernacle only had one. So are you seeing the pattern? The temple, bigger, more ornate, more... whereas, you know, the tabernacle might have one of a particular item, the temple would have 10. And it would be grander and on a bigger scale. Same way, there were 10 tables for the showbread. And you can see these lined up along the sides of the large room, the holy place. Tabernacle had one, and the temple had 10. And then finally, the bronze altar. The altar of the burnt offering is how it's described on this drawing. It was like 30 feet by 30 feet by 15 feet tall. Again, much, much larger than what was at the tabernacle. The tabernacle was 5 foot by 5 foot by 3 foot. This is 30 foot by 30 foot by 15. So, you know, it's 6 times larger in horizontal dimensions and 5 times larger in its height. So, the temple is bigger than the tabernacle. Bigger, more, and more ornate. Was the temple better than the tabernacle? I'll toss this out for discussion. Which was better, the temple or the tabernacle? Anybody want to hazard an opinion? Did he add stuff to what God said to do? That's a very good question. Actually, we'll get into David's statement. David made a statement about how God had guided and had directed him. And we'll discuss just what that means and to what extent David had divine inspiration in the layout of the temple. Colin? Right. It was, but and we have to temper that with the statement almost always made in that it was in your heart to do it. It was good. So God was pleased that it was in His heart to do it. And I'm going to admit that I'm going out on a limb here. I will be going out on a bit of a limb as I share some of these things. But I'll just share that I believe that the temple was, in fact, inferior to the tabernacle. And I'll share just a few reasons for doing that, and certainly cannot be dogmatic about it, but I'll just share a few reasons for saying that. The temple was more complicated than the tabernacle, and the simplicity was lost. The simplicity of the symbolism and the meanings, it got lost. Kind of like you might have a little country church where just a white board church, but people are coming and getting saved there. And then if you were to build a huge, fancy church and nobody gets saved, well, which one's the better? Obviously, things were going better with the simple arrangement. And that's too simple to make that conclusion for the temple versus the tabernacle. But simplicity was lost. And it's interesting that when we come to the New Testament, when God is wanting to use a typology to communicate a truth, He doesn't go to the temple to communicate the truth. He goes to Hebrews chapter 9, and what does He go back to? He goes back to the tabernacle. He says, I want to show you how things were, and He goes back and uses the typology of the tabernacle as opposed to the typology of the temple. In the tabernacle, there were no lights at all. There were no windows for light. The only illumination came from that one simple lampstand. But it was a lampstand of pure gold. And that lampstand we've seen as a typology of the illumination of the Holy Spirit. Well, we come in to the temple, and now there are windows in the temple. They don't know that they're narrow windows. They don't let in a lot of light, but they do allow some natural light. They depend somewhat on natural illumination for the illumination of the temple. So it's not all the illumination coming from the lampstands. There's some dependence upon natural light. We see huge cherubim in the temple. They're 15 feet high, and they're beautiful. They're ornate, but they're not solid gold. They are olive wood, and they're overlaid with gold. And so in that respect, they are inferior to the furnishings of the tabernacle, which were of pure gold. So we see things more ornate, more lavish in the temple. They're bigger. Are they better? Not necessarily. And in fact, there are some who would argue that, hey, things were better under the tabernacle than under the temple, and I would be one of them. But as I say, I certainly can't be dogmatic about that. That's not an issue on which the Scripture is clear, and others may have different opinion. So which was better, the temple or the tabernacle? Daryl thinks the tabernacle was better. But the tabernacle wasn't being used. It had, after 500 years, it was probably in some pretty bad shape. We know that it got used for 400 years, at least to some extent, before the Philistines captured the ark. And after that, we know that the town where the tabernacle was housed was overrun by the Philistines. We imagine that it got damaged when the Philistines took it over, and perhaps that's why the ark was never put back in there. But we can imagine that after 500 years, a tent would be in some pretty bad shape, so it would probably be needing some replacement anyway and after all. Let's take a look at Solomon's prayer of dedication in chapter 8. And this is really where I'd like for us to spend some time this morning. This is one of the most beautiful prayers, I think, in the Bible, is Solomon's prayer of dedication here in chapter 8. We see that after the temple has been finished, the ark is brought up, and all the furnishings are brought up, and many sacrifices are made. They made so many sacrifices that they could not even count the sacrifices. And later in the chapter, we're going to see that they made sacrifices, and the number was like 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep and goat at another time. And they said, well, and if they counted that many, but this time it was too many to count, I can't even begin to imagine how many sacrifices were made. But the ark was taken into the temple, the priest came out, and the glory of the Lord came in and filled the temple, just as it did with the tabernacle. Facing the assembly, verses 14 to 21, Solomon blessed the assembly, or he spoke to them. And in verses 14 to 21 of chapter 8, he reminds them of God's faithfulness and his promise to David, how he had made David a promise that he would accomplish the building of the temple, and that God had been faithful to keep that promise. And then he reminded them of the Ark of the Covenant. Like just as God made this promise to David and he kept it, he's got a promise that he's made to you. And it's in the Ark of the Covenant. And it's on those tablets. And we put that Ark of the Covenant in the temple. So he's reminding the people of God's faithfulness there. And he stands before the altar and he prays to God. He's spoken to the people now in verses 14 to 21. And now he's praying to God. And in his prayer that starts verse 22 and follows through the rest of the chapter, he prays for two things. The first thing that he prays for is a short little prayer. He praises God for being a covenant-keeping God, and he praises him for his loving kindness, or his chesed, to his true servants. And he specifically asks about this covenant that he made with David. He specifically asked that God would keep that covenant in regard to himself. So that's the first thing Solomon prays. He says, God, you made this covenant with my father David. Now please keep this covenant with me. Keep that in mind as we go through the lesson. That's the first thing that Solomon prays as he dedicates the temple. And then he gets into the dedication of the temple itself, the prayer to dedicate the temple itself, in verses 27 and following. And let's take a look here at reading at verse 27. And as Colin pointed out, this is right where Solomon is. "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee. How much less this house which I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of thy servant and his supplication, O Lord my God, to listen to the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prays before thee today, that thine eyes may be opened toward this house night and day, toward the place which thou hast said, My name shall be there, to listen to this prayer which thy servant shall pray toward this place, and listen to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel when they pray toward this place. Hear thou in heaven, thy dwelling place, hear and forgive." And so Solomon asked God to have his eyes open toward that house and to listen to the prayers of his people Israel when they pray to that house. This is why the Jewish people would face towards Jerusalem when they would pray, was because of what Solomon prayed right here. And you may remember the story of Daniel when he was in Babylon and in captivity. They told him, you know, they passed the edict that no one was to pray or make any petition of any king or God or man except to the king of Persia alone. What does the Bible say that Daniel did? It says he went to his room, as was his custom. He opened his windows, where? Toward Jerusalem, and prayed three times a day, as was his custom. So this is fulfilling what Solomon said. He said, when they face this house of yours, even though the temple had been destroyed for many years, he would still face that direction and make his prayers. And then Solomon specifically lists some situations when the people are to pray, and he asks for God to hear those prayers. He says, "If a man sins against his neighbor and is made to take an oath and comes and takes an oath before thine altar in this house, then hear thou in heaven and act and judge thy servants, condemning the wicked by bringing his way upon his own head and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness." So some of the specific prayers that he's asking God to regard is to judge between the innocent and the guilty in verses 31 and 32. When people confess their sin after they're being defeated by an enemy, verses 33 and 34. When they confess their sin after a time of drought in verses 35 and 36. When they come in confession after famine or pestilence or plague, verses 37 to 40. And even the foreigner who seeks refuge in the God of Israel, verses 44 and 45. We have Israel when they're going out to battle. I think I missed one there. It's actually verses 44 and 45. And even when they are taken into captivity due to their sin, looking far centuries into the future and seeing that period of time when they would be taken captivity, and they would turn and pray, just as Daniel turned and prayed. The Bible says that Daniel saw in the writings of the book of Jeremiah the number of days that were to be accomplished, and he began entreating the Lord regarding that. These were things that Solomon asked, that the Lord would give regard to his people when they prayed to him. Chapter 8, verse 54 through 61. "And it came about that when Solomon had finished praying this entire prayer and supplication to the Lord, he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread toward heaven." What an humble position for the king to be in. What a contrite heart. "And he stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, Blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel according to all that he promised. Not one word has failed of all his good promise, which he promised through Moses his servant. May the Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, which he commanded our fathers. And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God, day and night, that he may maintain the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel as each day requires, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God. There is no one else. Let your heart, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and to keep his commandments as at this day. Now, after he prayed that prayer, this is when he sacrificed the 22,000 cattle and the 120,000 sheep and goats, and he did it with burnt offerings and grain offerings and fellowship offerings. And you'll remember, the burnt offerings were entirely consumed. The fellowship offerings, they would burn a portion of it and eat the rest. But think of the logistics of burning 142,000 animals. Remember that picture of that altar? Even that huge altar, it's not big enough. You cannot burn that many or sacrifice that many animals on that altar. So what he did, he consecrated the entire court, and they just burned animals through the whole courtyard as a sacrifice. So they would take the animals from the fellowship offering, and they had a feast for 14 days on that fellowship offering. Nevertheless, with all of this, God was pleased. We have to walk away noting God was pleased with this, these actions on the part of Solomon and on the part of the people. The Chronicles account, we've already talked about how we saw the glory of the Lord coming and filling the temple after it was dedicated. The Chronicles account also tells us that fire came down from heaven and consumed these sacrifices. So God was pleased with the actions of the heart. And they feasted for 14 days, and on the eighth day, he sent the people away, and they blessed the king, and they went to their tents joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. Now, afterwards, we come into chapter 9, and what were the two prayers that Solomon prayed? There were two main aspects of his prayer when he dedicated the temple. What was the first aspect of his prayer? It was kind of selfish a little bit. What was it? Keep the covenant that he made with David. And then the second aspect of the prayer was what? It was for the temple. Praises to God, but he was specifically asking God to do something in regard to the temple. Keep his eyes open to the temple daily, such that when people prayed, he said, would you hear their prayers? So two things he prayed: keep your covenant that you made to David with me, but also listen to your people when they pray at this temple or toward this temple. In chapter 9, we see God's response to that prayer. And understand that this wasn't right away. This was many years later. God appeared to Solomon, and it says that he appeared, this was the second time, and that he appeared to him after all of his building projects were complete. We know it took him at least another 7 years to build his palace. We don't know how many years it took him to do all the other mighty building projects that he did, but some period of time, many years later, God now appears to Solomon the second time, and he responds to that prayer. And he responds to the second part of the prayer first. He responds to the part where Solomon asked God to listen to people when they pray. And let's see what God says here. See, now it came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. I'm in chapter 9, verse 1. As he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Now this is a big deal. God is appearing to Solomon. This is a big deal. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. And as for, so he's answered, that's the first part of the prayer, God answered. Now, I'm sorry, he's answering the second part of the prayer. Now he's going to address the first part of the prayer, where Solomon specifically asked for the covenant of David to be manifest in his life as well. Verse 4, and as for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So, again, it's the same conditional promise that he's already made. But if you or your sons shall indeed turn away from following me and shall not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you and shall go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all persons, and this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and they adopted other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this adversity on them. So with that, we're going to put a little peg in our lesson here, because this is a segue into next week's lesson as to the life of Solomon, and we'll draw our applications actually next week from did he make it, and to what extent did Solomon follow the Lord, and how was he faithful in doing this. But we'll stop here for this week and go to a time of prayer. And Gary, if I could ask you to come and lead our class in prayer, and then we'll pick up again here next week.